Hi, this is Stanley Bronstein, the founder of SuperChangeYourLife.com. Welcome to another in our ongoing series of interviews titled, How One Person Can Change the World. In this series, we're interviewing people who are using their ideas, passion, and energy to change the lives of others. Today, we're interviewing Dr. Oren Wunderman. Oren Wunderman has worked in nonprofit child welfare agencies or mental health centers for most of the last 30 years. He's licensed as a psychologist, marriage and family therapist, and mental health counselor. He earned his bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees from the University of Miami. He's taken coursework in nonprofit management from the Harvard University School of Business and the Florida International University School of Business. For the past 15 years, he's been a yearly guest lecturer in the subjects of child abuse and forensic psychology at the University of Miami, Departments of Counseling and Clinical Psychology, Miami Children's Hospital, and several local community mental health centers. Dr. Wunderman has been with the Family Resource Center of South Florida for the past 16 years, 11 of which he served as its executive director. During his tenure, FRC has tripled in size while expanding the complexity and scope of services. He says he encourages his staff to follow the values of transformational leadership, whose cornerstone beliefs are, treat the clients respectfully, always caring for them as though they were loved members of your family, and always preserve a fundamental humility and awe about the vital services provided to troubled clients. There's more, but rather than go into a lot more detail about his background, it's time to let Dr. Wunderman tell us more about himself and his current activities. Doctor, welcome to Super Change Your Life. How are you today?
I'm good, and thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to talk with us. Let's go back before we get started in the meat of the subject. When you were growing up, did you have any idea you were going to be doing what you're doing now?
Well, I did a little bit. I was always kind of a natural listener, and I gravitated towards listening to people and observing people. And I came from a family, both my parents had a sense of social service and commitment, so I always thought I would be in some aspect of the helping professions. And going into psychology and child welfare seemed like a pretty natural transition for me.
So you grew up around a pretty good background. A lot of the person you are today, you owe to your parents, I guess.
Yes, they both had a very strong sense of social service, of social commitment. They would talk a lot about such things as the social contract and talk about various Renaissance philosophers. So I was really very lucky to be hearing that and exposed to that at a young age and to develop a sense of social contract, social responsibility to others.
That you are indeed very lucky. So as you went to school, did you work along the way, or did you pretty much follow the straight line where you got your bachelor's, master's, and then PhD, and then went to work?
When I went to school, we were actually allowed to work full-time, and so I did work full-time throughout all of it. I remember there were very long weeks. I remember there was lots of caffeine in those weeks. But the good news was it gave me clinical experience. It gave me service experience working with others. And also, frankly, the good news was since I was working all those years, my student loans were modest when I finally graduated. The other thing that was very helpful is that by the time I graduated, I had worked in a number of mental health settings so that I was able to land at a very nice series of jobs that advanced my career and that I found very rewarding.
You sounds like you were indeed quite lucky that you followed a natural progression. It almost sounds like you're one of those rare instances where you sort of knew what you wanted to do all along the way and you just went out and did it.
Yeah, I was lucky. And one of my very first professional jobs, I worked in a model program that was a combined federally qualified health center and state-certified mental health center. And the person who ran it, who founded it and ran it, was a physician who had written papers about community medicine and community mental health from Harvard. And they imported him. He was a Harvard-trained and Harvard professor physician. They imported him down to Miami, and he ran this very large combined health center and mental health center. And I eventually rose to the top to become one of the division directors. And it was a wonderful learning experience in terms of provision of clinical services, the training of staff, and also in terms of management.
Now, let me ask you this. Let's How did you come to the Family Research Center? Resource Center, I'm sorry.
In the middle 90s, there was a very large shift in private practice climate. I was in full-time private practice as a psychologist. I was doing a lot of court work. I was doing a lot of child abuse work. I was in court perhaps between 4 and 10 times a week. And the two factors that started to weigh on me, one, I was in such an adversarial setting all week, it was just getting to be a little wearing to have so much adversity in the week and to have X number of people angry. I was the psychologist for the Child Protection Team of South Dade for a number of years. And in that regard, there were a number of times that I had identified people who I thought were abusers, and I would wind up going to three different courtrooms. I would go to the dependency courtroom to deal with the abuse charge, the criminal courtroom to go with the criminal action, and then the family courtroom to go with custody issues. And then sometimes even civil courtroom to go with tort issues. So after a while, all that litigation started to wear me out. And the second factor was that as far as providing therapy, the country was shifting towards a managed care model, and people were getting, and there was less and less ability to earn a living and more filling out of just fairly useless paperwork. And so I decided I wanted to be more useful, and I wanted to be less stressed as far as being in court 4 to 10 times a week. So I looked around for an agency that I could work in that had a corporate mission that resonated with me. Back then, this agency was called Parent Resource Center, and it changed in the late 90s to Family Resource Center. But its corporate mission is the prevention and treatment of child abuse and the strengthening of families, which is a corporate mission that resonates with me. So I began in March of 95 working as a division director, and then in June of 1999 I was the interim executive director, and then in December of 99 I became the executive director, and that's the position I've held since December of 99.
Now, I bet you see the full gamut of issues, don't you?
Yes, I often sit back and I think that I get to see the very best of human nature, and I get to see the very worst of human nature. There are times that I see really depraved child abuse and without remorse and without rehabilitation, and the kids are really damaged and they don't get better. And other times I see that a parent genuinely rehabilitates herself or himself. They had a drug problem, an alcohol problem, or they were with an abusive boyfriend, and they got it. Once their lives and their parenting was being supervised by the state, and they had a lot of interaction with the court and interaction with my staff, my case management staff and my mental health staff, they realized, you know, this is not the life I wanted to lead. I want to be a better parent. I want to take care of myself. I want to take care of my kids. And they grew, and they rehabilitated themselves. It's wonderful to see, after perhaps a 12 or 18 month intervention with the court and with my agency, they're able to get back custody of their child or children safely, and they're enormously grateful. They're profoundly grateful, and they go on to lead productive lives where they take care of their kids well, and that is just endlessly, deeply rewarding.
Why do you think some people get it and some people don't?
Well, that's a very good question. The short answer is that you look at the personal strengths of someone and the degree of what's sometimes referred to as morbidity. If you have someone who has always had in their adulthood or their teen years a drug and alcohol problem and always, you know, gone from abusive relationship to abusive relationship and has no capacity to look inward, then the chances of that person getting better are pretty remote. But if they have a capacity to constructively look inward rather than blame others, if they have a capacity for what's called an internal locus of control, where they say to themselves, you know, I'm the architect of the good things that happen to me, and I'm the architect of the bad things that happen to me. If they have those two things, the capacity to be constructively self-reflective and have an internal locus of control where they look in and say, you know, I basically created this mess through my behavior, and I can make it better through my behavior. Those folks will get better, and they'll reach a level of functioning that will surprise them. You know, we have the county's only dependency drug court program, where we work with a very fine, innovative, creative judge who runs what's called the dependency drug court. These are parents who've been identified by the state as abusive or neglectful as a result of a drug or alcohol problem. And they're worked with very intensively. They come to court every week instead of every month, and the staff sees them three times a week instead of a couple of times a month. And this program has a very high success rate, and these people are exhilarated. When I go to the graduations and they talk about feeling reborn, and they have a sense of hope, and they had contemplated suicide before, and there may have even been multiple suicide attempts, and you see their wrists, and you've seen where they slashed their wrists and so on. And now they're stronger. They're actually happy. They're actually delighted to be an effective parent. They're delighted to be an employed person taking care of herself or himself. That's very rewarding to see. But I think the short answer to your question is a capacity to look inward constructively and a capacity to assume an internal locus of control.
I love what you just said. I have, you know, it's amazing. I've talked to so many people, and I've thought so much about this subject, and I've never heard it put more plainly or succinctly than the ability to constructively look inward. You've summed it up in one sentence. It's very good. You've obviously thought about this.
I have. I've thought about it with the clients I've seen. I've been doing this now 35, 36 years. And also, I'm now in my 60s. I've had a lot of chance to reflect on my own life. And so I have thought about what I've seen for myself that's worked or not worked, and what I've seen with several thousand clients that's worked or not worked.
So you... Now, let me ask you a question. Faith. I'm guessing that you have a lot of faith in human people, don't you?
I do. I overall think that net-net people are good. They may take a tangent here and there where they do very bad things, but net-net I think people are good, and I do believe in the restorative power of taking self-control. I do think that people can... There are two ways to look at it. Either they can rehabilitate themselves or habilitate themselves. Rehabilitation means they can work their way back to a previous high level of functioning, and habilitate means they can reach a level of functioning that they never had before through their own efforts. And I do think that people can do that, that with effort and self-monitoring and, you know, putting one foot in front of the other each day in a constructive way, people can do that.
Now, as people work to either rehabilitate themselves or habilitate themselves, it by definition, and going inward, it requires a little bit of looking backwards, doesn't it?
Yes. You know, it requires looking back and saying, these are the places I made some poor choices, and this is what I really should have done. This would have been more life-loving. It would have been better for my child or children. So it does require... You know, the way I've had phrased this to clients is, you know, I want you to be moderately self-critical. I don't want you to be oppressively self-critical.
Ah, you're it's funny. You're jumping the gun, but keep saying that. But that's the very next issue I was going to raise. I love it. You're right.
Yeah, moderately self-critical. And it's not useful to be oppressively self-critical. It's not useful to talk about, oh, I hate myself and blah blah blah. But it is useful to turn a moderately critical eye on one's own, you know, self-destructive or self-defeating behavior and figure out what would be better in the future.
The way I always put it is the past is what we should learn from, not where we should live.
And I agree with that.
And when we beat ourselves up, as you would say, oppressively, we're living in the past.
Right. There was, back in the 1970s, there was a psychologist who looked at a group of what he referred to as self-actualizing people, or fully functioning people. And they were people, I'm trying to think, Mahatma Gandhi, Madame Curie, Albert Schweitzer, Albert Einstein, Franklin Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt. There were others. And they looked at what made these people so, he looked at what made these people so exceptional. And there were four or five factors, but one of the biggest factors was what he referred to as time competence. And he said the most effective people, he thought, were people who looked into the future for 10 or 15% of their consciousness, and people looked in the past for 10 or 15% of their consciousness. But the people who were constructive and forward-moving and had a higher level of contentment were focused in the present around 80% of the time, 80-85% of the time. And so a certain amount of therapy involves teaching people to be more time competent.
I love what you're saying. I could talk with you. I can listen to you for hours. I mean, it's amazing. I pulled out a note card and I've already written down a card and a half of notes from what you said. That's I appreciate it very much. Now, so you obviously believe in personal growth, don't you?
Yes. Yes, I do.
And the number one way, I guess, to personally grow is to develop the ability to constructively look inward?
Yes. Look inward, stop blaming others, and don't just passively relinquish yourself to circumstance. Realize that to a very large degree, we are the architects of our own circumstances. And in most instances, we can make it a lot better.
Do you think people all too often spend a lot of time looking outward, looking for
yes.
somebody to blame, circumstances to blame?
Yes, I think it's a real problem that people, they're looking for others to blame or others to make it better. They don't have an internal sense of competence or an internal sense of personal responsibility. And they need to focus more internally and I think more responsibly and say, you know, it was my behavior, it was my multiple bad choices that got me into this situation. So it's going to have to be my behavior and my multiple good choices that's going to get me out of this situation.
What can we do to help people do that?
I think there has to be some settings where people can allow to self-reflect and self-explore without negative consequence. And, I mean, the best place would be if parents understood that one of our main goals as parents is to teach self-sufficiency, is to teach children how to be their own problem solvers with their own internal locus of control, and to teach kids that, you know, when you make an error, not if, but when you make an error, you do a calculation on why you did it, what the bad decisions and behaviors were, and how you can fix it. And I think to a large degree, parents need to teach kids to be problem solvers, to be self-reflective problem solvers, and I'm not sure we're doing that.
And so a lot of adults who don't have that ability, it's because their parents didn't teach it to them when they were children. And I think a lot of it, a lot of times parents are doing the best job they know how to do.
I agree with that completely.
And they quite simply just don't know what to do. I mean, I think of my own father. My mother died when I was 8 years old, and so my father had to raise me after that, mm-hmm. and he only had a fifth grade education,
mm-hmm.
but there were a lot of things he did not know how to teach me, but he did know how to teach me right from wrong. He knew how to teach me the value of hard work. He knew how to teach me how to stay out of trouble,
mm-hmm.
and things of that nature.
Those are good lessons.
Yeah, those are the most important ones.
Mm-hmm.
I think. And he also, as I like to say, he only had a fifth grade education, but he had a PhD in common sense.
Yes, those are very good, very good things to teach. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I know, I'm saying I think I was also very fortunate, and a lot of people don't have that.
A lot of people don't have it, and a lot of people, you obviously prevailed over the significant trauma of losing your mother at a very young age. And some people don't prevail. Some people stay miserable or bereft, or they get into a repetition compulsion of trying to find the lost mother. So, but it sounds like you carried on. And I do think with the earlier point you made, I do think we give what we got. You know, if we got good common sense, proactive parenting, then we tend to visit on our own kids good common sense, proactive parenting. But if we had abusive parenting or neglectful parenting or harsh parenting, then we tend to visit that on our kids unless we are very self-monitoring.
So it's a matter of breaking the cycle.
Yes, breaking the cycle. And what I tell people is, adult living is effortful. Adult living is an everyday event of considering our choices. If you think that effective adult living is easy, then you haven't given it a lot of thought. Adult living is effortful.
Can we switch gears and talk a little bit about the adoption system? You work a lot in the adoption system, don't you?
Yes, we do.
Can we talk about that, please?
Sure. My agency, which is the Family Resource Center, is a combined foster care agency and community mental health center. We work with children and families that have been referred to us by the court system or by the Department of Children and Families in Florida because they've been identified as abusive or neglectful or exploitive of their kids. And under the state law, there is a case plan that's correct, that's developed by the courts after expert witness testimony has been taken, and the client, the parents, have 18 months in which to satisfy the court-ordered case plan. If they satisfy the court-ordered case plan, then they're able to get their kids back safely, or if the kids remained in the home under supervision, then the supervision is withdrawn. And what we find is that about two-thirds of the time, at the end of the 18 months or so, the case plan has been met and the state can withdraw its supervision. And we feel very good about that. It's a very nice story about rehabilitation. However, about a third of the time, the parents are not able to meet the tasks that are prescribed in the court-ordered case plan. And the most common areas of failure would be drug and alcohol abuse, or be staying with an abusive boyfriend or husband, or inability to control one's temper. And so when a parent has demonstrated the inability or lack of desire to succeed in the case plan, then the state terminates the parent's rights. And then we have an obligation to figure out a good disposition for the child, a permanent placement for the child. So we have sort of a pecking order. We try and find a placement with known and stable family members, such as an aunt or an uncle or a grandmother. And that would be our first choice. And then if we cannot find that, then we try to do adoptions. So this agency does anywhere between about 80 to 130 adoptions a year. And then, a very sad situation about a dysfunctional family being broken up by the courts through termination of rights turns out to be a positive situation in that the child then gets a fresh start. They're with a loving family that has been with the child for, usually there's a getting to know you period of 3 or 4 or 5 months where everybody's confident that it's a good fit between the child and the pre-adoptive parents. And then we go to court and we have a very nice adoption ceremony. And so as I say, we do between 80 and 130 adoptions a year, and that's a good story. And the adoptions rings as a very sweet thing for me as well. My wife and I adopted our kids, one 26 years ago and the other 24 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's always nice to see that adoptions process.
Can we switch gears and talk a little bit about the negative side? You see some people who never get it and they're never going to get it. Mm-hmm. And how does that turn out?
Well, there are times when a substance abuse disorder or a mental health issue or a domestic violence issue blocks the parents from satisfying a court-ordered case plan. And then there's usually a trial, a termination of rights trial. Sometimes we're able to talk the parent into surrendering his or her parental rights. Although I say about half the time it goes to trial and the judge hears the evidence and terminates the parents' rights. And I'd have to say very often they're bitter. They're angry with us. There have been times we've had security concerns about very angry parents. There are some times when they just fade away. They leave the state and we never hear from them. And in some ways, I think they're relieved that since they were kids trying to raise kids, in some ways they're relieved that they no longer have those adult responsibilities. But it's nice then to see a reconstitution of a family through adoption or through a child going in with an aunt or an uncle or a grandmother.
Now, let me ask you, in order for someone to rehabilitate themselves, mm-hmm. I guess one of the key words is there has to be an element of forgiveness. There, yes. Both forgiveness of yourself and forgiveness by the people around you.
Yes. I think that's a very good point. I actually think forgiveness is even written about in the psychotherapy literature, that at some point after you have turned a moderately critical eye on yourself and you've done a biopsy or autopsy of your mistakes.
I love the distinction you just made, but anyway, go ahead.
Right. And then you forgive yourself and maybe in some instances try to seek the forgiveness. You make apologies and try to seek the forgiveness of others around you, and then you move on. I mean, I do think you have to be able to clear the deck emotionally to be able to move on and parent well. And what I see is certainly the courts are thrilled. I mean, when parents satisfy their court-ordered case plans, most of the time the judges get from behind the bench and they give them a big hug and they take pictures, and everybody's delighted. I mean, they're delighted to see a family is moving on. So certainly there's no, holding of grudges in the court system. And the same is true for my staff. We often have clients then who send pictures about how their kids are doing for years and years. If we put all the pictures up, we'd have an enormous wall of pictures of kids who've, safely gone back to parents, and also pictures of kids who've gone off for good adoptions.
So is that one of the reasons why your organization's been recognized as the top 100 best places to work 2 years in a row?
I think that's one reason. I think there are three or four reasons. I mean, for one is, when we hire, I tell people that this needs to be a passion. This can't just be a job. This needs to be a passion. And I also tell people that, but for the grace of God, or if you don't believe in God, then the fortuity of random numbers, it could be any one of us in this kind of mess. And I want you to have the humility to realize that the trials and tribulations that these people are going through could have been us if circumstances were different. And so I want you to treat them with that respect and with that humility. And so I think that's part of it. And my supervisors are that way, too. My supervisors, for them, this is a calling. And they're, even though, yes, we have to make sure the paperwork is right, and yes, we have to make sure all the pleadings and so on are right, this is fundamentally a service to try and help people who could have been any one of us. And in fact, as I talk to staff, sometimes I realize they once were foster kids themselves, or they themselves had some issue early on in their lives with difficulties parenting.
Well, we have like a minute or two left. Is there anything you would like to add to what you've already said?
Well, just two or three things. One is that, yes, I do believe the human spirit can be rehabilitated. It's effortful. It takes time. You do have to look inward. But so even if your listeners out there are having a very difficult time with their life circumstances, I do believe in the restorative capacity of the human spirit. I've seen terrible things happen to people, and they pull themselves back into a happy and constructive life with effort and time. The second is on the subject of child abuse. If you think it's going on, don't just look the other way. Whatever state you're in, every state has an abuse hotline. Call it in. Discuss your concerns with them. It's completely anonymous. By federal law, it has to be anonymous. And so if you think abuse or neglect is going on, definitely call it in. The third thing I would say to you is, and your listeners, if someone ever wants to be a foster parent, whether it's in the state of Florida or whatever state your listeners are in, there are lots of good agencies that have good foster care programs, and there are many different ways to foster. You could be a short-term foster parent, a respite for a weekend or two, or more long-term. And the last thing I just wanted to say is that if you can't do any of those things, you might join a board of directors, or you might every now and then make a donation to help agencies that are foster care agencies. And I thank you very much for the opportunity for us to speak today.
You're quite welcome, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
It's been my pleasure.